Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And that debt is fraud. It's now or never, folks. We're literally depending on... I'd hate to say the divine hand of providence. Of course, we can't do anything without him. And I don't want to say I hate to say that. That's almost bad there. But we know he loves us. We know he will perform the miracles necessary. But I have to say that there has to be some level of introspect here. At what point do we actually start assuming the responsibility for our failures in acting? That's why I say it's now or never. And, you know, I'm not being overwhelmed. And I guess because of that, it's kind of a blessing to have somebody like Tammy, people like Woody, and other people, Michelle. I mean, there's so many, Chip, I could go on, Paul. And my fear is, as I start naming names, that somebody else will actually say, well, he didn't mention my name. And it's not about me. This is not about me. This is about you. We have a lot of people that are learning and doing, and they're doing what they can. And they're kind of scratching their heads. What's holding you up? Why are you not waking up? Why are you just standing there on the sidelines allowing this crap to happen? It's one thing to say, well, I don't think it's very clear what we need to do. Tammy, do you think it's very clear what we need to do?
I mean, I think you are doing a tremendous job at trying to teach us all of what we need to do.
Okay.
But that doesn't mean it's clear to us.
Oh, okay. If you can't refute it, because you know, we have the Doubting Thomases, right? But the Doubting Thomas never abandoned the Christ, right? He was an apostle to the day he died.
Mm-hmm.
He doubted. He had questions. He needed his curiosities to be answered. I have those people. As a matter of fact, I could name names. And as a matter of fact, you people who know because you ask, you push back, you push back, you push back, that's only because it's not necessarily whether you're rejecting, it's just that these are questions that you need to know. And didn't the Lord promise, ask and ye shall receive? And the reality, I've had a lot of people work with me. I've yet to have anybody ever come back and say, I worked with GR and he's a fraud. Because that just hasn't happened. I haven't taken money. I've really done everything I can to try to step aside from that, even though the John Birchers and other people, that guy's out for money. That's not true. And it's not that I'm boasting. I mean,
yeah, that's definitely not true.
And I'm not boasting because the Lord's blessed us, but I'm capable, and we've been capable of doing everything we can for this nation. With what we've got, with what the Lord has blessed us. But, I mean, we have some responsibility. We prepared ourselves to be in this position. You know, we're not rich at all. But I am here to be able to consecrate my time to serve him and you. So, as I look at what the heck, it's now or never, folks. Just because Trump is in office, everybody thinks all of these are good things. And I'm here, if you haven't started catching on, that these things have nothing to do with restoring our constitutional republic. It's about more control, more power going into a different direction. That's all. And you're going to rue the day if you don't do something about this, because I'm not immortal. I'm not going to live forever. I hope the day I see him come. That's only a hope. That's only a prayer. That doesn't mean that that's going to come true. As a matter of fact, I have people that, you know, naysay the Doubting Thomases. Oh, and they, and you know, I don't know if you can't get away with saying, I said the infinite day of when it's going to end. Oh, you said the days are getting shorter. They are. They're continuing to get shorter. I know. Nobody knows when it's going to happen. Right? And, I mean, if I said, I would be lying. But don't tell me that the days are getting shorter. The time when everything goes haywire is getting closer. I thought that, you know, we may have had some retrospect. I think that may, and as a matter of fact, I've gotten into some really deep conversations with people where I've basically said, I think this is about the time, but only the Lord knows. I always qualify it with only the Lord knows. Not even, mm-hmm. I mean, it was even stated that not even the prophets would know. Only he would know. No one on this earth is trusted with that knowledge. I think, you know, John the Revelator saw it, and he was trusted, but he was constrained from not telling us so that we wouldn't mm-hmm. have that knowledge. You know, life would be so much easier if we would have had, you know, a YouTube channel throughout Adam and Eve's time and all the way throughout all the discourses of time, right? We could just watch the YouTube of, you know, Adam's advice of what we need to be doing and why we need to be doing that. But then we would never develop ourselves spiritually. We would be told what to do instead of praying and putting scabs on our knees to try to figure out what we need to be doing and using faith and moving forward in faith. Faith is a huge principle here. And folks, you need to start applying some faith. So we're going through the obligatory. So please, as you've learned and pray, please get up and act. It is all about holding our public servants. When we talk about our government, it's not the edifices. It's not, you know, these structures and these seats and everything else. It is the people. And that those people have created a bureaucracy that becomes a permanent parasite because they want to feed themselves, and they're getting better and better at feeding themselves off of us. That's why I'm exposing this whole Department of the Interior going through all of these different acts. We're just wrapping up. On Friday, I will be wrapping up the 1820 Land Act, and then we'll be opening up that, what I think it's an 1803 or 1804, whatever it is, an act during Jefferson's time that kind of set that ball in motion as they started, you know, taking the Constitution literally by literally disposing of the land, by selling different parts of these territories and so forth. But to be clear, folks, you need to get involved. Now, with that, welcome back, Tammy. And where we left off,
thank you.
If I remember correctly, we're still in June 16th, and we just finished Mason covering his pushback on jurisdiction, and basically he was stating that there needed to be a finite clause in the Constitution that literally said that power not delegated could not be acted upon. And basically, he wanted the 10th Amendment added to the Constitution before it got ratified. And that would cause me to go down another rat hole to say, look, the Constitution didn't need that. And the fact is, the Constitution delegated very specific powers. Even though the Articles of Confederation delegated very specific powers, but it wasn't nearly as delineated and defined as this Constitution. As a matter of fact, this Constitution did so much more in creating checks and balances and so forth. And to think the arrogance of holding up the Constitution and saying, you got to add this before we can ratify it. Actually, so that's where we kind of closed off yesterday. I said it made no sense to do that because the Constitution had been clarified that they could only do these things enumerated. The duty of the states was to basically keep this in check by keeping this front and center. Had the states maintained their honor and integrity in holding the federal government accountable, but when they came out with the Assumption Act and the state and the federal government said, we're going to give you states some money. Well, hold on here. If they were actually honoring their job and honoring their oath of office, they wouldn't have accepted that money. The states would have actually stood up and said, you can't do this. But they didn't understand what they were doing because they didn't focus on these ratification debates. Only these men that were here. And so this is why I really highlight this. Every time a new state joined the union, it should have been the standard that that state got these ratification debates so that they could go through these, that they would understand the responsibility of becoming a party to the compact. And that every state, and you know, this goes down this path of, we're not supposed to have religious tests, but it sure would be right, and I think it's well over time, to start demanding that our public servants have a profound understanding of the Constitution before they can step into office. Have them certified that I do understand what I'm supposed to be doing. That keeps them from doing things they shouldn't be. Or at least we can hold them accountable. All of these things are coming to us today because we've allowed ourselves, they allowed themselves to start deviating and letting the federal government operate illegitimately. Never once did the Constitution create or was amended to say if the states ignore you, there's no statute of limitations in the Constitution. Folks, you won't find it. If the federal government can violate the Constitution for 20 years, it becomes permanent. No. Or if the court can determine that what they want to do is better than what the Constitution says, that becomes legitimate. No. The Constitution is clear. You must do everything in pursuance to the Constitution. This is why, in the obligatories, I keep telling you, it is all about full compliance to that Constitution. People that want to run around with their own little agendas and say, oh, well, we got to have a convention of states, or, oh, we need to, get education focused this way. No. If they don't have the authority to do it, we need to shut it down. I don't care if it's good or not. The only thing that they can shut down and still basically shift over, because they can actualize this, the shutting down of all of these programs is what would benefit the union. But shutting down Social Security, because there's too many people that have become dependent on that. They let it go for so long that there are generations that are now dependent on that. And so therefore, the shutting down of the Social Security doesn't mean that you won't get your support. But the people that are coming in, or I should say, those people will never be adjoined to it. They will never be entitled to that. They may have to help pay off the debt for that. But that's it. But those people who have paid, you just draw this line. And this is what Milton Friedman said. Draw the line and say 40 years old. When you do this, if you're 40 years old, then you'll get, your Social Security and you'll continue to pay into it. Everybody before, if you're 39 or younger, you don't pay. As a matter of fact, whatever you paid into it is sealed and done. You shift the liability of taxation from paying through the Social Security tax for those, and they basically, will be paying a general tax that will basically underwrite the rest of those who will be basically using the system in 25 years. So basically in 40 to 50 years, the entire Social Security administration, the system itself, will go away. Something like that. I mean, there'll be a few people mm-hmm. that may linger longer, into their hundreds or so. So it may go 60, 70 years for a few people. But that only means that there'll be probably one person sitting in a little corner office in the Treasury that will actually be maintaining to ensure, okay, that person's died, we're all done. The burden of what we did to the American people is no longer the albatross, across us or over our backs or on our necks or what have you. The burden has been lifted and we can move forward. Every person going in between, if they paid any money, they will basically be compensated, paid off for that money that they put in.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it. You're not going to get the retirement program. Now, if you want to amend the Constitution to do that, I warn against it. You need to move that to your state. If you want your state to have a Social Security program, then you need to do that. Don't let the federal government be involved in this. And as a matter of fact, they shouldn't. And as a matter of fact, I don't think that the states would actually, if they would have been presented with an amendment and they understood what was going to happen. Now we know what's going to happen. I'm confident that the states would not allow an amendment to go through to basically create another national retirement program. So all that being said, we kind of left off with Mr. Mason. Mr. Henry gets up, and then he read the 8th and 13th article of the Declaration of Rights, which was done. And basically the 8th to the 13th article, those Declaration of Rights in the Articles of Confederation. So anyway, Mr. Nicholas then in reply to the gentleman, so go ahead.
Right, Mr. Nicholas, in reply to the gentleman opposed to the clause under debate, went over to the same grounds and developed the same principles which Mr. Pendleton and Mr. Madison had done. The opposers of the clause, which gave the power to providing for the general welfare, supposed its dangers to result from its connection with an extension of the powers granted in the other clauses. He endeavored to show the committee that it only empowered Congress to make such laws as would be necessary to enable them to pay the public debts and provide for the common defense, that this general welfare was united not to the general power of legislation, but to the particular power of laying and collecting taxes, imposts, and excises for the purpose of paying the debts and providing for the common defense. That is, that they could raise as much money as would pay the debts and provide for the common defense in consequence of this power. The clause, which was effectively called the sweeping clause, containing no new grant of power. To illustrate this position, he observed that if it had been added at the end of every one of the enumerated powers, instead of being inserted at the end of all, it would be obvious to any one that it was no augmentation of power. If, for instance, at the end of the clause granting power to lay and collect taxes, it had been added that they should have power to make necessary and proper laws to lay and collect taxes, who could suspect it to be an addition of power, as it would grant no new power if inserted at the end of each clause, and it could not when subjoined to the whole.
Okay, so did what he say to in this part, did this sound familiar to you? Because you've actually read this a couple of times where they basically said, had they actually adjoined that language at the end of each granted power, instead of putting it at the bottom, it would have been redundant. But it basically says the same thing. So the way he said it this way, I didn't want to interrupt you. The way he said it this way, I think, because he actually gave you the example. For instance, at the end of the clause granting power to lay and collect taxes, it had been added that they should have the power to make necessary and proper laws to lay and collect taxes. Who could suspect it of an additional power? As it would, basically, I kind of misread that. Who could suspect it to be an addition of power? As it would grant no new power if inserted at the end of each clause, then not, it could not when subjoined to the whole, which is that little part of the clause, the aforegoing powers. That's why it says, you know, they can create all laws necessary and proper to the aforegoing powers. That's it. It doesn't give them the ability to create a new power. They can, you know, make the laws necessary and proper for these powers above. Anyway. So I think he did a really good job to help everybody understand that the necessary and proper clause does not mean the what it defines today. You know, most people just skip over the aforementioned. What does that mean? What does that mean? What's a for? Or aforementioned. Anyway, so let's go ahead and the legislative powers and limitations.
Delegated powers, yeah. Okay, he then proceeded thus, but says he who is to determine the exact of such powers, I say the same power which in all well-regulated communities determines the extent of legislative powers. If they exceed these powers, the judiciary will declare it void, or else the people will have a right to declare it void. Is this depending on any man? But says the gentleman, it may go to anything. It may destroy the trial by jury, and they may say it is necessary for providing for the general defense. The power of providing for the general defense only extends to raise any sum of money they may think necessary by taxes, imposts, etc. It says he, our only defense against oppressive laws, consists in the virtue of our representatives. This was misrepresented. If I understand it right, no new power can be exercised. And to those which are actually granted, we trust to the fellow feelings of our representatives. And if we are deceived, we then trust to altering our government. It appears to me, however, that we can confide in their discharging their powers rightly from the peculiarity of their situation and connection with us. If, sir, the powers of the former Congress were very inconsiderable, that body did not deserve to have great powers.
Okay, so one thing I just want to go back to, and actually when you see it, folks, it'll be red and big and bold, and actually the font is greater. This one line he says, if they exceed these powers, the judiciary will declare it void, or else the people will have the right to declare it to void, or declare it void. What he means there is that if the judiciary fails to do their job, we have the responsibility, and I think what he really misses over this, because he talks about the people. We're not a democracy. We're a representative government. And this is why Madison comes back and kind of has to educate everybody, even back then, that the state legislatures need to actually stand up against the judiciary, who failed to call it, declare it void, and actually stand up and say the judiciary has failed to do their job, and so we have to demand and interpose for you to do, you know, to cease and desist. You have no authority to do this, which is exactly what Madison and Jefferson did in 1798 with the resolutions against the Alien and Sedition Acts. The judiciary didn't do what they were supposed to do. We learned this. But even in 1798, when the judiciary was not an activist bench, the activist bench came in when when John Marshall became the Chief Justice with the Federalist Papers. When he was appointed in 1800, this is when the seeds were planted in the Black Robe Regiment that they would pervert and transform this nation from a Republican form of government to a judiciary form of government. And don't think they haven't done it, folks. Everybody runs and hides from the judiciary. Because what does he say here? If they exceed these powers, the judiciary will declare it void, or else the people will have a right to declare it void. In other words, at the state level, our representatives will have the right to declare and interpose. They understood this, but he didn't get into the little nuances so that you could understand what they were saying. It wasn't until 1798 where those nuances truly came out to what these men understood in the paradigm. That yes, we had the right, the people had the right, their representatives at the state level had the right to step in on their behalf. If our state fails to do it, then what do we do, Tammy? The county is supposed to do it.
Redress and grievances.
Well, right. But you skipped a point. So if the state legislature fails to do it, then the county legislatures, they should be informed enough to say, hey, you guys got to fix this. If the county legislators fail, then we, the people, have the right to declare it void to our county, to basically demand that the state declare it void amongst the rest of the states. So in other words, when you look at these petitions, there's a reason why we start with our counties, and then when we get the counties to actually start doing their job, what do? We tell them to actually promulgate and get all of the counties to get involved so that we all start focusing on actually taking back this power. That way, in focusing and taking back the power at the state level, then we can get the states to do the exact same thing we just did at the counties to take back the state. The states will then take back the federal. And it shouldn't take long to do this once you really understand. Anyway, we're going into a break, so we'll be right back after this. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, wow, where did the time go? Huh? I mean, Tammy, you can pull me out of these rat holes. Anyway, it's not like we're covering a lot of ground.
Maybe people want to listen to them.
Okay, maybe. So the next point we're going to bring up, though, is common law. Now, this is where Mr. Henry, actually, 2 points. Mr. Henry is going to talk about, and these are anti-federalist comments. So you can bet that he's putting this negative spin, which has probably lends to violating the Constitution, where, oh, he's creating this paradigm that they can't, they don't have the authority to do this, but they're going to do this. And then it'll be really bad for America. And so got to keep in mind that everything that they're basically trying to, you know, get people to look at is all based upon the premise that they're not following the Constitution. Okay, so let's take a look at the Bill of Rights first. Go ahead.
You mean...
Well, Mr. Henry. Yeah, so Mr. Henry, actually, if you go up to Mr. Henry, because after the legislative powers and after what you just covered, Mr. Henry first talks about the Bill of Rights. He says, Mr. Chairman, the necessity of the Bill of Rights. You get that? It's up before the
barriers.
It's actually up before the common law. So if you go back to where you were.
Oh, okay.
Okay, right. You got the Governor Randolph, then Mr. Mason, then Mr. Henry. And the first thing he starts talking about is the Bill of Rights. So go ahead.
I don't know where we're at.
Okay, so go back to what you just read where I highlighted that one part. If they exceed these powers, the judiciary will declare it void, or else the people, if, from that paragraph, right underneath that, Governor Randolph then speaks. And then right underneath that, three lines. And Mr. Mason says maybe 10 lines. Then Mr. Henry speaks, and then underneath Mr. Henry, there's the Bill of Rights, and he says, Mr. Chairman, the necessity of a Bill of Rights. That's highlighted. You don't have that?
Mm-mm.
Okay, well, just read that very first paragraph that Mr. Henry says, Mr. Chairman, folks, you'll get this because I'm posting with the highlights. Mr. Chairman, the necessity of a Bill of Rights appears to me to be greater in this government than ever it was. I mean, there's hyperbole, right? That's what he's saying. And so just read that whole paragraph.
I'm completely lost now. I'm sorry.
Oh, okay. All right, so I'm trying to
find out where you're at, but I'm completely lost.
Okay, so I'm just going back up to the legislative powers and the jurisdiction where we were. Then he proceeded thus on that paragraph you just read. Okay? And I'm sorry, folks, but, you know, you may be just equally confused. You see the paragraph that you just read where it starts off with, he then proceeded thus. This is on page...
I don't know if my computer just jumped to somewhere completely different. What page are we on?
278. So when I asked you, you just read, you go, yeah, and I guess you thought you saw it, but you... Okay, anyway. So you see the legislative powers and limitations, right?
Yes.
Okay. Underneath that, Governor Randolph, then George Mason, Colonel Mason, and then Mr. Henry, and there's this little, the Bill of Rights. Is that highlighted for you?
No.
So Mr. Henry, and this is on page 279, when Mr. Henry, you see Mr. Henry? You see Mr. Henry in the navigation pane, right?
I see Mr. Henry in the navigation, but...
And the very first
line...
It goes
down to... Okay,
the very first line, it starts off with, Mr. Chairman, the necessity of a Bill of Rights, that the line's there, right? You see that?
It is there. It's not highlighted, but
okay,
it's there.
That's fine. I don't have two copies, so my bad. Do you see the next one, the common law one?
Yes, that's where it starts off for me as being highlighted.
Oh, okay. So yeah, go ahead and read this Bill of Rights then. Go ahead. Because what he's going to do is he's going to basically try to impose fear upon the delegates. Oh, we can't let this Constitution go through without a Bill of Rights. The Anti-Federalist goal was to stop the ratification in its tracks so that they would not have, because if they stopped it, there's no way of restarting it. They knew that they needed to get it stopped. So go ahead, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, the necessity of a Bill of Rights appears to me to be greater in this government than ever it was in any government before. I have observed already that the sense of the European nations, and particularly Great Britain, is against the construction of rights being retained which are not expressly relinquished. I repeat that all nations have adopted this construction, that all rights not expressly and unequivocally reserved to the people are impliedly and incidentally relinquished to rulers as necessarily inseparable from the delegated powers. It is so in Great Britain, for every possible right which is not reserved to the people by some express provision or compact is within the king's prerogative. It is so in that country which is said to be in such full possession of freedom. It is so in Spain, Germany, and other parts of the world. Let us consider the sentiments which have been entertained by the people of America on this subject. At the Revolution, it must be admitted that it was their sense to set down those great rights which ought in all countries to be held inviolable and sacred. Virginia did so, we all remember. She made a compact to reserve expressly certain rights.
Okay, so...
Do you want me to keep going?
No. So... This is what he says up at the very top. I have observed already, and in other words, he said, I've already said this, that the sense of the European nations, and particularly Great Britain, is against the construction of rights being retained which are not expressly relinquished, which is why you have to have a Bill of Rights. This Constitution does not have a Bill of Rights. It expressly delegates specified powers. What he's not saying here is that in these other nations, they have general powers. So that a Bill of Rights was absolutely necessary to protect the people. And the first country of Europe to do this was Britain with the Magna Carta. So all of the rest of Europe started, you know, maybe following suit with Britain, but it took them centuries to even come close. And so they finally came up with their own way of expressing with platitudes how they're going to respect the rights of the people. They did that with the Magna Carta, like I said, and then it was only proven centuries later in Britain that they weren't honoring the Magna Carta. They weren't honoring the rights of the people. Therefore, they had to fight another revolution. But instead of having land barons drawing swords upon the king, the people actually had to have a revolt. So there was literally a revolution in Britain in the 1680s where they basically stood up against the tyranny and says, we have rights. And they spilled blood to do that, to get the glorious Bill of Rights. Because the king, everything was under the king's prerogative that was not basically held to the Magna Carta. Well, at that point, he was even denying the Magna Carta, the rights that they had under that, which is why they said no, and then they added to the Magna Carta a Bill of Rights to protect them from those things that, you know, at that point in time, they didn't include in the Magna Carta. And so what he's basically saying here is we have to have this. And he's actually obviating, he's basically obscuring the fact that this Constitution is not a general Constitution. It does not delegate general powers, which is why the Bill of Rights was not necessary. It was nice to have, but it caused more damage because the people only cared about the Bill of Rights. Oh, well, we got our Bill of Rights, which is why the government started doing things that they shouldn't have done. They started assuming general powers because these men demanded this Bill of Rights. The people forgot about understanding what powers they had and what they didn't have. And that's how they got out of that box. Do you understand? Does that make sense?
It does, yeah.
So this is how they started basically, you know, doing these land Ponzi schemes with the states. Because everybody lost sight of the delegated powers, what they could do and what they couldn't do. So the Bill of Rights, like I said, you can't convince me otherwise. The Bill of Rights was more dangerous than anything else. The only role that the Bill of Rights really had, the only role that they had, was that they were there when the Civil War ended so that we could take the Bill of Rights and apply them to the people of the states by using the 14th Amendment. That's when the Bill of Rights became relevant, because there was never really civil rights problems per se badly where the federal government was the bad guy. The federal government actually enabled the states to be the bad guy, and that's what they did. So anyway, so let's go ahead and get down to the common law where he kind of makes these comments as well. Go ahead.
Okay. What barriers have you to oppose to this most strong, energetic government? To that government, you have nothing to oppose. All your defense is given up. This is real, actual defect. It must strike the mind of every gentleman. When our government was first instituted in Virginia, we declared the common law of England to be in force. That system of law, which has been admired and has protected us and our ancestors, is excluded by that system. Added to this, we adopted a Bill of Rights. By this Constitution, some of the best barriers of human rights are thrown away. Is there not an additional reason to have a Bill of Rights? By the ancient common law, the trial of all facts is decided by a jury of impartial men from the immediate vicinage. This paper speaks of different juries from the common law in criminal cases and in civil controversies, excludes trial by jury altogether. There is, therefore, more occasion for the supplementary check of Bill of Rights now than then.
So what he basically says here is like a straw man's argument, because he basically says at the very last part, he says, this paper speaks of different juries from the common law in criminal cases. Well, hold on. The federal Constitution doesn't deal with criminal cases other than two. Within the boundaries of the United States, which is treason and counterfeiting. They don't have, and they don't try you for murder. They don't try you for stealing. They don't try you for any of the criminal types of acts that people would do. Horse thief, you know, horse thievery, whatever you want to call it, whatever. Racketeering. Anyway, the point is that He's creating a smokescreen that says that they don't have common law. This was already laid out before, that the reason why, and Madison said it at the very beginning of the debate, that all of the states' laws and the way they were constructed in applying their own common law was different. And so, and this is because, folks, the states at that point in time were theocracies. I mean, the Anglican Church was a part of that state government. I mean, there was a symbiotic relationship in eight of the states with the churches. So common law was really based upon the doctrine of that church, if you understand what I'm saying, because the sins were the crimes. And so as he's trying to point out, well, he wanted to actually create, because had the federal government dictated to the state what the common law would be, it would have given Henry another point and a more specific point to say, look, they're not going after these laws, they're going after those laws. And what about these laws? He's creating a complaint that doesn't stand, because the federal government was created to be able to interface with all of the states and their appeals on those things that arise only under the Constitution. Does the federal government have the ability to hear an appeal over a murder case? Well, yeah, if it arises under the Constitution, but it's not in the Constitution today, folks. So there's no appeal into the federal courts for crimes, because the jurisdiction of the court is based on things arising under the Constitution. And they've used the Bill of Rights as if those are powers and so forth. The fact is, they can't create law. They can't. If there's a problem that's coming forward in an appeal to the federal court because some spiffy lawyer wants to get this into the federal court should shut it down and say, look, the Bill of Rights, protects the people from you, not from us. And therefore, if there's a violation with that, that state court has to deal with it, or the people need to interpose. Like it was said earlier by, I think it was Nicholas, or maybe Nicholas or Pendleton, when he said that if the jurists do not call it void, call the law void, or call what they did void, then it goes to the people. Well, as I went in this long oration, that what that means is it goes to the state legislatures. The representatives of the people of the states then have to stand up and interpose and call it void. If they fail to do it, then it has to go down to the county legislators to tell the state legislature, you're wrong. What's going on up there is wrong. You need to get together with the other states and declare it void. So it requires a multitude or the majority of the counties in the state to correct that state legislature. If that doesn't happen, because this county legislatures are ignorant and sitting on their hands and got their greedy mouths open for the next crumbs to drop into their mouths, then we, the people of the counties, need to hold them accountable to say, look, this is all wrong. You're the first person that actually has to get up, and you account to us. And if you don't, we're getting rid of you. That's why it starts with we, the people. In a grand scheme of things, instead of giving you the full hierarchy in the ratification debates, because Mr. Grayson gets to this down the road, Mr. Grayson sees the relationship between the states and the federal government as the counties and the state government. He says basically it's the same thing, that we have to hold each other accountable by the parents. We, the people, are the parents of government. But the government that we actually create, our child, is that county government. And therefore, we hold our child accountable. And then, is it right? Should we actually step around our child to basically chastise their children? No, we got to get our children to behave properly as parents. And they're not going to teach, they're not going to learn, they're not going to do what they need to do if we bypass them. And that's not even right anyway. That's basically defying the order, the divine order of holding everybody accountable. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, okay, good. All right, so I hope that kind of clarified everything. Because bottom line, what Mr. Henry was doing was he was creating an argument that, in England and throughout Europe, they had to have a Bill of Rights. And then we have to have common law as we've defined it here in England with the federal government. That would have created a contention across all of the states, because all of the states would have said, hey, we don't do that here. We don't do those things. We do these things. So this goes back to the whole design of the Constitution was to be flexible enough to allow every government underneath it to self-determine. The federal government was not going to come in and start knocking heads and saying, you got to get rid of your church, your symbiotic relationships with your church, you got to get rid of it, you got to do this. Had they done that, because Patrick Henry would have loved that, because now he can say, look, they're trying to change us and make us like what they think is best for us. Who are they? That would have been the argument. It would have shot it down. The Lord knew. They knew the cunningness of these men. Or I should say, those who were whispering in their ears, and that was basically Satan, or the devil, because the devil is the only entity that was actually trying to stop this. And these men became pawns. They became players for becoming the contentious ones and not recognizing a superior system. Anyway, okay, so let's go down to Mr. Nicholas and the next, oh, actually, hold on here. If you, because we do this, if you don't scroll, scroll down to the end of the paragraph, mm-hmm. and we see that there's these other two lines. So go ahead and read these. Thank you.
Yep. Okay. It is not this sufficient to alarm men? How different is this from the immemorial practice? Immemorial practice of your British ancestors and your own. I need not tell you that by the common law, a number of hundreders were required on a jury, and that afterwards it was sufficient if the jurors came from the same county. With less than this, the people of England have never been satisfied. That paper ought to have declared the common law in force. In this business of legislation, your members of Congress will lose the restriction of not imposing excessive fines, demanding excessive bail, and inflicting cruel and unusual punishments. These are prohibited by your Declaration of Rights. What has distinguished our ancestors that they would not admit of tortures or cruel and barbarous punishment, but Congress may introduce this of the civil law in preference to that of the common law.
Okay, so what he's basically laying out here is the same thing, and he's trying to assert that the federal government actually has jurisdiction over these different types of crimes, that they would create these excessive bails and these excessive fines. What are the two crimes? Thomas Jefferson pointed this out in 1798. And I think if Thomas Jefferson was in the ratification debates, I think he would have recognized, hold on here, what crimes are you talking about? The only crimes they have jurisdiction over is treason and counterfeiting. So what's your problem? Everything else is left to the county or the states and the counties of how they're applying common law. There is no appeal to the federal courts over these issues. And I think Patrick Henry was a great obviator. He was really good at getting people to look at the way he wanted you to see things. Just a little story. And this is a true story. I don't know the precise point when this happened. But Patrick Henry got on a roll, and I have to read through the debates to find this point in time. But he got on a roll where he was really preaching holier than thou, and he basically got to a point where in his oration he was concluding with this: if I'm wrong, then so help me God, strike me dead. And at that point, because a storm had descended upon this location where they were holding this debate, the convention. And a storm basically, you know, was brewing. Everybody was aware of the storm. And Patrick Henry, you know, kind of talking at the top of his lungs about the perversions and blah, blah, blah. And when he said that, literally a bolt of lightning hit this building. Pow! And everybody ran. Because they realized that the storm was upon them. And I think people kind of connected the dot that God was going to strike Patrick Henry down. So it was so apropos that you couldn't have, I just don't think it was a coincidence. I think that he was taking so much latitude that he basically put himself out there, and God, just like that, responded with that bolt of lightning. And so they basically adjourned because everybody ran to go, to a place of, a smaller building for protection. So they all went back to their rooms or where they were staying and what have you, and got out of that big hall, because a big hall is just a big target. And the reality is that, that is a part of history that I think most people need to understand. how it kind of lent to, you know, maybe, you know, this actually, if you believe in God, this actually speaks to how God actually kind of injected here in the ratification debates. He shut Patrick Henry down. Anyway, and that's a true story, but I've never heard people, you know, connect those types of dots like I just did, because, you know, it was just a, you know, coincidence. Are there really coincidences? Mm-hmm. You know, yeah, I guess so. Anyway, yeah, I flip something, you know, up in the air for me to catch in my mouth so I can eat it, and it, you know, lands in my eye, and I lose my sight. Okay, that coincidence. Well, maybe. Anyway. Anywho, so let's go down to Mr. Nicholas, who basically then has these things to answer the two gentlemen last up. So he's going to kind of refute this. Now,
okay.
We only have 2 minutes left. This is why you need to keep me out of the rat holes, or we're not going to make it through this, and we'll still be covering the ratification debates while people are singing Jingle Bells. Because I think we got two more states to do. We got New York, which is, I like to do that last, and I think we'll do New York last, just because if we run out of time as we get through August, if we don't get through New York, that's fine. I tell people, go. It's a long debate, but it's basically Hamilton, you know, killing time, basically getting into theory. He doesn't really make very good arguments at all, because he knows the sentiments are this. If Virginia ratifies, New York has to ratify, because they would be out and not being able to defend themselves and their positions with another big state, because they were the next big state, next to Virginia. And so they didn't want Virginia taking control and steering the ship, because that's how they saw this. Where the power was vested in the states, that's where, you know, they would be able to have that control, and they wanted, you know, they wanted their hands on that helm as well. Anyway, so I hope that makes sense. So that's why Madison, mm-hmm. and actually Hamilton, kept on begging Madison, let me know as soon as, you know, you guys ratify, because I can then go in there and say, hey, Virginia's ratified, now what are you going to do? Are you going to let, you know, the Virginians have the full presidency? You know, wouldn't we want to have a New Yorker and as a matter of fact, that actually became a part of the conversation in Virginia. They said, if we don't join the Union, then Washington can't be the first president. These men kind of understood those ramifications as well, and so did those people up in New York. And so if you go through the Virginia ratification debates, you'll actually find where that's brought up a few times. You're going to keep Virginia out of the Union so Washington will not be our first president? The nation demands he be our first president. Interesting, huh?
I didn't know that.
Yeah. Yeah, so all of these things, everything that they can use and do to help sell the argument. I mean, this is sales 101, always be closing, trying to create that next argument to close the deal. So anyway, folks, with that, we're laying it out here. We're basically proving to you what this Constitution really means and how they were trying to obviate it. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.